Paramount Broadcast Center, this is Take Two. Me, Martinez. With the U.S. pulling out of the Paris Accord, it's left a big climate question on the table. How can cities such as L.A. meet ambitious emissions reduction goals without the federal government pitching in? We're going to hear some answers. Plus, how some innocent blades of grass may be the big reason why our wildfires spread so fast. And here's the thing, that grass should not even be here. It's all ahead on Take Two. From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take Two. I'm Martinez. Thanks for choosing us on a Tuesday. Coming up, we're going to hear about Councilmember David Rue's plan to create a college savings account for every single student in LAUSD and how KPCC's education reporter Kyle Stokes banded together with a local fourth grader to get to the bottom of some not-so-tasty water in an LA school.
Dear Mr. Kyle Stokes, my school doesn't have any clean water. That makes me very concerned. That water tastes horrible.
Mr. Stokes, the kind of respect Kyle gets. All right, you're going to hear that story in about 30 minutes, but let's start with the environment. Now, this week, the U.S. started the formal process of withdrawing from the Paris Climate Accord. The Trump administration notified the United Nations Monday. That was the first day the U.S. could leave under the agreement. That move comes more than 2 years after the president announced his intent. And that window gave cities such as Los Angeles and states such as California time to join forces to reduce emissions. For more on where their efforts might go from here, let's talk to Leah Stokes, assistant professor in climate politics at UC Santa Barbara. Leah, thanks for making the time.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Sure. All right. Now, nearly 200 nations pledged to cut greenhouse emissions under the Paris Agreement. The goal was to keep the increase global average temperature to well below 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. So let's start with a bit of a checkup. But how would you characterize the state and the direction of the climate right now?
Well, unfortunately, even though the Paris Agreement is going to try to limit warming to 2 degrees Celsius, and keep in mind that we have already warmed the planet by 1 degree Celsius, so we're halfway to that target, unfortunately, the pledges that countries around the world have made only add up to limiting warming to 3 degrees Celsius. So we are not on track even before the United States has become a laggard and started to withdraw from the Paris Agreement. Overall, countries around the world are not doing enough to try to reduce greenhouse gas emissions.
And Leah, real quick, just in case there's someone out there that says, well, 1 degree, what's the big deal?
Well, do you live in California? I think you've seen the big deal. We know that climate change is already impacting our state. We have had 2 times as much land burn in the western United States that would have otherwise if we didn't have climate change. And we have 500% more risk for wildfires because of climate change. So that 1 degree Celsius that we've already experienced, that's in our backyard. It's been causing the drought that we've experienced in California, as well as a lot of these wildfires. So the costs are really starting to add up already.
Now, President Trump announced his intention to pull out of the agreement back in June of 2017. Cities, states, and businesses then took up the reins on those reduction efforts. What kind of responses have we seen on the parts of cities and the state over the years on this?
So for many decades, starting in the 1990s, states and cities have been trying to lead on the climate crisis. California is one of the most important places in the world in terms of trying to reduce its greenhouse gas emissions. And it's done a lot of things to try to reduce pollution from cars, from the electricity system. But unfortunately, right now, Trump is suing California for its ability to try to reduce emissions. Other states like New York are also stepping up. But unfortunately, even though we have really important leaders at the state level and even at the local level, we have lots of laggard states as well. So, for example, West Virginia only has 5% of its electricity system right now from clean energy. So we really need a federal policy in place to make sure that all states and all cities are doing everything that they can to fight the climate crisis.
I know that more than 400 city leaders have joined the Climate Mayors Association. 17 states have joined the U.S. Climate Alliance together. About 60% of the U.S. economy is still committed to the Paris Pledge. Leah, how much power do these partnerships really have to help uphold America's commitment? Or is it, if the federal government is out, that means everything else is in jeopardy?
Well, I totally applaud the cities and states that are stepping up, and even there's some companies, too. But the challenge is that, especially at the local level, these cities don't really have the jurisdiction. They don't really have the tools in their toolbox to make really big changes. We need the federal government, which, of course, has the power of the purse, the ability to tax and spend money, to be giving money to local cities that are trying to do the right thing to reduce their emissions. We need money for things like public transit investments, for retrofitting homes, for cleaning up our electricity system. Everything that we have to do costs money, and the local city councils already are pretty stressed. So it's pretty hard for them to be doing this without any federal leadership or support.
Talking to Leah Stokes, assistant professor in climate politics at UC Santa Barbara. So Leah, is it a little bit hopeless then if the U.S. doesn't participate to meet these goals? It sounds like it kind of is.
Every country in the world has to have their own debates domestically about this issue. And so I think that other countries are experiencing climate change already, whether that's India or China or places in Europe, and they have their own domestic reasons to continue to try to make progress. And although, as Elizabeth Warren said today in The Guardian, we currently have a climate denier-in-chief with Donald Trump in the White House, the clock is ticking on that man's time, hopefully. And I'm hopeful that come this time next year, we'll have a new government and the United States can once again take leadership on this important issue on the international stage.
You mentioned China and India. Is there some thought that other countries will be less willing to meet climate goals if the U.S. is out?
Well, that's the whole theory of an international negotiation, that you basically work together to try to reduce emissions. But at least in my own research, it doesn't really seem that that's true. I think that a lot of countries are doing this because there are reasons to do it anyway. There's a lot of pollution, for example, in India. The air quality is not very good. And citizens living in that country are demanding that their government do more to clean up the air. And of course, just when we burn coal and it makes the air very dirty, it also releases greenhouse gas emissions. So India has its own domestic reasons to start to clean up its electricity system. And the same can be said of China. You know, China, if it invests in electric vehicles, can create markets around the world for its products. So I think that countries are still going to be working on climate change. The question is, are they going to be doing enough fast enough? And without the U.S., which is really an innovation driver for the world, without the U.S. in, that's going to be pretty difficult.
You know, when Secretary of State Mike Pompeo announced the U.S. would be leaving the Paris Agreement on Twitter yesterday, he said, quote, the U.S. is proud of our record as a world leader in reducing all emissions, fostering resilience, growing our economy, and ensuring energy for our citizens. Ours is a realistic and pragmatic model. Leah, is it really?
No, he's lying. We know that our federal government right now has a very creative relationship with the truth. They are perfectly happy to, you know, promote climate denial, to say that the planet's not warming. It's really unfortunate that he would spin this really terrible decision as somehow protecting the environment. But I think he's doing that because he knows that the American public wants climate leadership. You can see that. Even Republicans, particularly young Republicans, are very worried about the climate crisis. So I think that they are on the wrong side of this issue and that the Trump administration is going to pay an electoral cost at the ballot box for this next year.
Let me ask you this, though, Leah. Let's just say things stay in place at the federal level for another 5 years. So let's just go all the way to 2024. Can the U.S. jump back in at that point, or is that time lost going to be too critical?
Well, here's the reality. We've already lost a lot of time with climate change. This is an ongoing process of delay and procrastination, and it is having consequences, particularly in a state like California, where we've had such devastating climate impacts already. So every day counts. Every day that we have a climate denier in the White House is bad news for the planet. That said, every time that we reduce our emissions, whether we start doing that tomorrow or in 2024, that also counts. So the sooner we get started, just like if you have a homework assignment that's overdue, the sooner we get started, the better and easier it'll be. But, you know, we can still make progress in 2024 if that's when we have to restart these negotiations.
Don't say that about homework, Leah. We're all procrastinators, all of us. That's our problem. Now mention 2020, an election year that could ultimately determine the country's direction when it comes to climate. Until then, though, is there an opportunity for California to take more of a leading role in reducing global emissions, if that's possible?
California is the world leader in terms of greenhouse gas emissions reductions. We have a cap and trade system that could be strengthened, but we have one in place. We also have very important clean energy targets that have been reducing the pollution from our electricity sector. We have, for example, a 60% clean energy target by 2030. That's a very ambitious target. And we're doing things as well in the transportation sector to try to increase the amount of electric vehicles on the road. So California is a real driver of innovation for the whole planet in terms of solar panels, electric vehicles. We are the world leader in terms of trying to address the climate crisis.
One more thing really quickly. We're going to hear from one of LA's chief sustainability people later in the show. But is the city right and correct in pursuing its own Green New Deal? Really quick.
I do think that all the places in the United States have a responsibility to step up and address the climate crisis. And so Los Angeles and New York City have really taken the reins on that. And I do applaud Los Angeles in trying to become a climate leader.
Leah Stokes is an assistant professor in climate politics at UC Santa Barbara. Leah, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me on.
All right, now let's talk about wildfires. California has been besieged by them lately, but there's been an uptick in other states too, like Montana and Alaska in recent years. Now, one factor in that could be invasive grasses, grasses that are not native to North America. That's according to a new study from the University of Massachusetts Amherst. Emily Fusco is a postdoctoral researcher. She led the study. Emily, welcome to Take Two.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Now, researchers have studied the link between invasive grasses and wildfires before, but how was your study, the one you conducted, different from previous research?
Most previous work has looked at maybe one or two species within an ecosystem or on some small scale. This is the first time that we've been able to put together a dozen invasive species impacting ecosystems across the entire U.S. So this is a really large-scale look at what might be going on with invasive grasses and fire.
Now, what about the data said to you that there's a strong link between these grasses and the increases in wildfires that we've seen, not just here in California, but just nationwide?
Yeah, so when you compare the places where we know some of these grasses exist to nearby spots where they more than likely aren't present, we saw these marked increases in rates of fire.
Now, here in California, you found that a species called cheatgrass is particularly problematic. What is cheatgrass and how does it contribute to the increased frequency of wildfires?
So cheatgrass is one of the best studied invasive species out there. And so what it does is it's this small-ish kind of grass that is essentially very fine fuel. And what that means is that it can dry really quickly and just catch a spark really easily compared to vegetation that might be native in that system. And then it also can help provide a continuous fuel bed. So in a place where there might not be anything to burn, we now have this really flammable fuel source.
So say a fire sweeps through an area, does it grow back really fast?
It does. So these grasses, generally, they really like fire. So once there's a fire disturbance, the grasses can recover really quickly. Here, I'm in Arizona right now looking at bufflegrass, and we were at a site where there was a fire just a couple of months ago, and the bufflegrass has already resprouted.
We're talking with Emily Fusco, researcher with the University of Massachusetts Amherst, talking about the role of invasive grasses in California's wildfires. Emily, where did these grasses come from originally?
All of these grasses were introduced by people. Some of them were accidental introduction. Some of them were intentional. So it could be seed crop contaminant. It could be forage for livestock or ornamental plants.
Do you know if any of these invasive grasses burned in any of the recent fires in Southern California? I know there have been a lot, but I'm wondering if there's any evidence to show that these grasses have had anything to do with it.
Oh, yeah. I wouldn't be surprised if they're involved, but it's too soon to say. It's hard to make a definitive statement on that.
So what can we do then? Can we just rip them out, take them out, and just make sure that they don't come back? Or is that something that's impossible to do at this point?
So that's something that we're trying in a lot of places. But once these grasses get established, it can be really time and labor intensive to remove them. So it's a lot of prioritization in those situations about what kinds of places we want to try to rescue from invasion And one of the most effective things that we can do is try to make sure that the grasses don't get to a new area to begin with. So a lot of early detection and rapid response is key here. So you can be vigilant about getting the grasses out before they take over.
So literally, if we see some grass, say something to someone.
Yeah, definitely. There are places where you can report invasive species. Usually different states have different things. And yeah, they're things that you want to watch out for.
That's Emily Fusco, researcher with the University of Massachusetts Amherst, talking about the role of invasive grasses in California's wildfires. Emily, thanks a lot.
All right, thank you.
All right, I will never, ever forget my first bank account. It was a Security Pacific Bank savings account. Anyone who grew up in L.A. remembers that place. Now, I got my little deposit and withdrawals booklet, and every once in a while, I'd add a few bucks to it. I don't remember exactly what I was saving toward, but I do remember feeling like I was working towards something. Well, an L.A. city councilman wants to take that idea and apply it to every kid in LAUSD. The goal is to get them thinking about college. We'll hear what he wants to do when Take Two continues in 60 seconds. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm A. Martinez. Los Angeles City Councilmember David Rue wants to open college savings accounts for every student in the school district. Starting in the first grade, each child in an LAUSD school would be automatically enrolled in the program and get $50 to start them off. District-sponsored programs and fundraisers would help grow that investment. Now, the proposal is getting a vote tomorrow, so we invited Councilman Rue on the show to explain it.
Children's savings accounts already exist in other cities like San Francisco, Boston, St. Louis, and many others. So this is something that's been around, but this will be the largest school district here in Los Angeles with LAUSD. It's simple. It's basically a savings account for every child in LAUSD that's dedicated for higher education. Where do they go to college or a trade school? And here in LA, we're calling it Opportunity LA. A universal program that's for every student, regardless of zip code, income, immigration status, housing status.
Now, the account would be held or owned by who? The kid, the parents, the city? Would it be all three?
It would be owned and registered to the child. But the child could access these funds and withdraw them only when he or she graduates in the 12th grade. We are hoping that this feature will also allow families to use this as a regular savings account so they could add more money.
So it isn't necessarily to make college affordable. Is it more to give kids and parents a goal of college?
Yes. I went to college because, not because I wanted to be a doctor or make more money. I went because my parents told me I was going to college. That allowed me to have a totally different life and different trajectory. But now my friends that I grew up with, who lived literally across the street from me, they were no different than me. They were just as smart, they were just as capable, just as worthy of a college education, but no one told them that they can go to college, that they can get higher education. And that's what this program does, which is so important because in our city, 80% of our LAUSD students are living at or below the poverty line. 17% of our students in LAUSD are homeless. So many young people hear that you can't do this. Now we're saying you can.
We're talking about giving children savings accounts to every kid in LAUSD with LA City Councilmember David Rue. Now, if you give each first grader $50 for free, that'll cost the city $2.35 million a year. Now, that's over $23 million by the time the program finishes a full cycle. Councilman, where will that money come from?
The first 2 years of this program is completely grant funded from the state and the federal government. And we have like Governor Newsom, who back when he was mayor of San Francisco, started this program. And he has already bought in and he's already committed an additional $25 million from the state budget to programs like the college savings account, including our own mayor, who also, when he was a council member, was trying to push this idea. So there is a lot of commitment from our leaders, from the state, the federal government, the CDBG grants, where we can draw down funds.
Now, what happens, Councilman, if regrettably a student doesn't end up going to college? For a lot of reasons. There could be a ton of reasons why that happens. Where would the money go?
If that's the case, then the money, the savings account portion where the family put in, they could withdraw that out, just like any other bank account. However, the $50 college savings part, as well as the many other incentives that we hope to bring together, they would not be able to withdraw that, and that would go back into the pot for the next first grader.
Okay, so I'm wondering then, once the money is deposited, say the parent doesn't add anything to it, but it grows and grows, is it untouchable? Or say if a parent were in a bad situation financially, could they have access to it somehow?
No, unfortunately, this is only dedicated for a post-secondary education, and it could only be withdrawn when the child graduates high school and applies and gets accepted to a post-secondary education.
Now, if the program passes tomorrow, what will the next steps look like?
I've been working on this project for about 3 years now. We have the complete buy-in of the school board and the school administration and the superintendent, as well as my colleagues on the city council, the mayor, and the county board of supervisors. So in reality, this is going to encompass not just LAUSD, but also LACO, the county board of education. And in year one, which will start this coming school year, we'll pilot it with about 10% of all first graders, which is about 4,000. And in year five, we'll start slowly ramping up till all first grader will have a savings account.
That's Los Angeles City Councilmember David Ruth. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I want to bring in Professor Michael Sherrodin. He's director of the Center for Social Development at Washington University in St. Louis and studies these types of programs. Professor Sherrodin, welcome to Take Two.
Great pleasure to be here. Thank you, Mr. Martinez.
Studies have shown students with these types of college savings accounts are much more likely to go to college. What have you seen in your studies?
We have a very large experiment running, and in social science terms, this is, you know, better data because it's a true experiment. We randomly assign some kids to an account and other kids not across the full state of Oklahoma, and we've been following them for the last 12 years. So we find that parents have a more positive outlook in several ways. One is that parents have a higher expectation for their children's education. We know that parents just feel a little better about their own lives. Also, the mothers have a little less depressive symptoms. We also find at age four that children have a higher social emotional development if they have an account.
Now, I call them CSAs, Children's Savings Accounts. There's a different name, too, as well, Children Development Accounts. Why are some called Children Development Accounts?
I've always used the term development accounts because the emphasis, I don't think, should be on the savings of the family. And sometimes if people use the term children's savings accounts, all people want to pay attention to is, you know, how much the family is saving. Because the purpose is really for children to develop and children to do well.
We're talking to Professor Michael Sherrodin, director of the Center for Social Development at Washington University in St. Louis. When it comes to starting the account, the initial deposit, I guess that would vary depending on the parent or depending on the program, depending on the area. But is there an amount that maybe signals, hey, this is serious. Let's take this seriously.
That is a great question. And we don't fully know the answer to that. In the experiment that we're running in Oklahoma, we were able to deposit $1,000 into accounts of newborns. I would prefer a CDA program that did deposit $1,000, something that really was meaningful and would grow over time in addition to whatever other deposits happen. But a lot of projects have smaller deposits. In Maine, they every child gets a $500 deposit. In Pennsylvania, it's a $100 deposit for every child. We do have some reason to believe, however, that just having an account that's called parents think is for college makes a difference regardless of the amount.
Professor, what kind of conversations have you had with kids about these child development accounts with school children?
Oh, one memorable interview was with a little boy who's five, and when asked, "What is this account?" And the little boy said, "Well, this is for my college." But then when the follow-up question was, well, what is college? He had no idea at all. It was a little bit amusing, but at the same time, effective, because the child really at a very young age already has the notion that there is this account and it is for his college. And the next steps, of course, is that he will figure out what college is and be in discussions about how to go to college and what does he want to be when he grows up. And so that's the kind of discussion that children's accounts will spur.
That's Professor Michael Sheradin, director of the Center for Social Development at Washington University in St. Louis. And we've been speaking with him about child savings accounts, like the one Councilman David Rue is proposing for L.A. Unified School District students. Professor, thanks for taking the time.
Okay, thank you. My pleasure.
Staying with school, a while back, a KPCC reporter got this letter from a fourth grader at a Los Angeles Unified School.
Dear Mr. Kyle Stokes, my school doesn't have any clean water. That makes me very concerned. That water tastes horrible.
Potentially unclean drinking water at a school? That's exactly the kind of complaint that'll get a reporter's attention. So KPCC's Kyle Stokes decided to look into it.
The fourth grader who wrote this letter, her name is Kaisa Dar, really loves her school, Clifford Elementary School in Echo Park. The kids are kind. The teachers are nice.
But a lot of kids are like, ew, no, I don't want to drink this water.
Even worse, Kaisa says the school's drinking fountain is outside, always in the sun.
The water is like hot and gross and like sizzling. It's gross.
To prove it, Kaisa brought some of Clifford Elementary's water to our interview. We went through a little water quality taste test based on a checklist I found online.
Does it taste like chemicals?
Not really. Mm-hmm. It's more of the metal taste.
Does it taste like, you know what, like a pool, like chlorine?
Yeah, it tastes like chlorine mixed with metal.
And not only does it taste funny,
it looks a little bit dirtier than other water.
It does. It's just a little bit yellow and a little bit cloudy, too. All of which got me curious. Long before the crisis in Flint, Michigan, LAUSD has been testing its water for lead. Since 2008, LAUSD has committed $45 million to testing all 60,000 of its drinking fountains, to flushing them, and more to shutting off or replacing them. And yet, after all of that,
ew, no, I don't want to drink this water.
So I asked the school district about Kaisa's letter, and it got forwarded all the way to the top.
I'm Mark Hovatter. I'm the chief facilities executive for the Los Angeles Unified School District.
He took Kaisa's complaint seriously. LAUSD went out to Clifford twice, called the LA Department of Water and Power to test the water, and finally sent the test results to me.
Nice to see you again.
So I went to share those results with Kaisa and her parents, Anna and Jonathan.
I've got the letter. And the answer is they found nothing.
Really?
Nothing bad?
That's good.
Nothing bad.
Good. That's great.
Yay.
To be a little more specific, DWP concluded the yellowish tinge was from iron rust in the water. And it's harmless, probably a byproduct of nearby construction. But after maybe 10 or 15 seconds, they found the water from the school's drinking fountain runs clear. So the solution, the district suggested, just run the water for a few seconds before drinking.
Is that okay with you?
Yeah, because I feel like that's teaching the kids to become more responsible.
I did wonder if LAUSD could do something more at Clifford, like maybe install some kind of water filter. But facilities chief Mark Hovatter says filters really only work if they're replaced regularly, which can get expensive. Plus, he says the city's water is normally pretty clean.
So I've committed that we will only put in filters where we need to. And we would ask our students to be as diligent as this student was to let us know when that's happening. Because if we let the water run for a couple of minutes and it's still coming out yellow, then there's a major problem.
Now, in case you're wondering, when DWP tested Clifford's water, they did not test for lead. But a few years ago, the school district did and found that all but one of Clifford's faucets tested below the FDA's limit for lead in bottled water, which is a stricter standard than the federal limit for tap water. But in 2018, the news site EdSource reported that more than a quarter of the water fountains at LAUSD schools still does test above that bottled water level of 5 parts per billion. That's not enough lead to legally require those fountains to be replaced, but pediatricians fear that no amount of lead in the water is safe. Covering education, I'm Kyle Stokes.
And if you'd like to tell Kyle about the water quality at your school or send a letter to any of our reporters, just remember our address.
KPCC 474 South Raymond Avenue, Pasadena, California, 91105.
Or you can look us up on our website, laist.com. That's laist.com. Earlier in the show, we were talking about the U.S. leaving the Paris Climate Accord and how that may affect L.A.'s emissions reduction goals. Mayor Eric Garcetti announced the city's version of the Green New Deal a few months ago, so we figured it's a good time to hear how L.A.'s doing with getting its energy grid all greened up. Find out where it all stands when Take Two continues. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. Amy Martinez. As mentioned earlier, the Trump administration formally notified the United Nations on Monday that it would withdraw the U.S. from the Paris Agreement on climate change. Now, it's not been a popular move, and many cities and states have said that they're still going to do their part to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, including Los Angeles. Mayor Eric Garcetti announced the Green New Deal in the spring, and the city's utilities are among the targets. Specifically, it calls for building a zero-carbon electricity grid within 25 years and making renewable energy count for 80% of our power supply even sooner. So to get a better understanding of where the city currently stands with greening the grid, we called up Nancy Sutley. She's Chief Sustainability Officer for the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power, and when we spoke, she explained how much of LA's energy currently comes from renewables.
Well, today we get about 30% of our electricity from renewable sources like solar and wind and some geothermal, and we are working hard to increase that amount. We have some hydroelectricity that we get from power plants that we own here in California, as well as a share of the Hoover Dam, where LA was part of the group that built it back in the 1930s. That percentage was likely not to grow very much. Where we're really focusing is a lot on solar energy, and now increasingly on solar energy with energy storage to help us better manage the grid with the renewable energy projects on them.
Now, a few months ago, the LA Times reported that LADWP was getting some of its power from a natural gas plant in Utah, despite Mayor Garcetti shutting down a pair of power plants in LA that were also powered with natural gas. A lot of people, Nancy, thought that was hypocritical. What do you think? Was it hypocritical?
Well, you have to remember that particular project. We are shutting down a coal-fired power plant in Utah, one that we have been in partnership with a number of cities in Utah, as well as other cities in Southern California, and replacing it with a smaller and much lower greenhouse gas emitting natural gas plant. And, you know, we are working towards meeting the city's goals and the state's goals to get 100% of our electricity from clean energy sources by 2045. So we will continue to work towards that goal. We've been working on a very detailed study of what it'll take to get Los Angeles to 100% clean energy no later than 2045.
What does it take, Nancy, to shift from natural gas to renewables? Is it just building more power plants, or is it just adding more solar to individual rooftops? What's the game plan?
And one of the reasons that this is a little more complicated is it's a different way to run the grid, and you have to deal with the characteristics of renewable energy that are different than the way we currently run the grid, and that's really to deal with, you know, when the sun doesn't shine, those solar plants are not producing electricity. You know, when the wind doesn't blow, those wind turbines are not producing electricity. And so we have to work on all of the pieces of the grid, whether it's the grid itself or things like putting energy storage like batteries onto the grid, and potentially other types of energy storage that will help us manage the grid with these increasing amounts of renewable energy. We're looking at lots of different types of storage, batteries being the kind of one of the big technologies, also things like pumped storage, which we already have on our system, the Castaic project, where we're able to use reservoirs in a sense to store electricity by when you pump up and when you release the water. And we're similarly looking at whether we could do something similar at the Hoover Dam.
Talking to Nancy Sutley, Chief Sustainability Officer for the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power. And we got some people saying that we have less than 10 years to get emissions under control, but shifting that utility grid to renewables obviously takes some time. Can you lay out a timeline for us? What large-scale projects is LADWP pursuing this year and 5 years, then maybe in 10 years?
Well, we have goals around renewable energy to reach 55% renewable energy by 2025, 80% by 2036, and 100% renewable energy by 2045. So those are sort of the milestones that we're looking at. The other thing that's, I think, important to note is also we're similarly making very good progress in reducing our greenhouse gas pollution, our greenhouse gas emissions that contribute to climate change. So LADWP has reduced its greenhouse gas emissions by almost 50% since 1990, and we expect that by 2030, not just LADWP, but all the electricity producers in the state will have reduced their greenhouse gas emissions by 80%. The real challenge is around transportation, because more people means more cars, more people moving around California, and we're not making as much progress in reducing our greenhouse gas emissions out of transportation.
Now, your agency isn't just working toward renewable energy. LADWP is also going to need to supply a lot of electricity as transportation shifts away from fossil fuels to electric vehicles. How is LADWP building in that kind of supply to support EVs?
Well, we're very excited and enthusiastic about supporting the move to electric vehicles. And so we're looking at a number of different things. We have very generous rebates for folks who want to put in electric vehicle chargers. We will basically cover the cost of a charger, whether at your home or in commercial garages. And in addition to that, we have a rebate for folks who want to buy a used electric car. And so we're about to triple that rebate to make it really cost effective for folks to buy an electric vehicle. So we're going to increase that used electric vehicle rebate to $1,500.
And on the vehicle charger thing, Nancy, that's always the thing that people say that stops them from buying an electric car, is that, well, there's just not enough electric charging places for my car, so I'd rather not. There's a gas station on every corner. Do you think someday there'll be a point where that won't be an excuse, at least in Los Angeles?
Yes, you're right. These electric vehicle chargers have to be visible and available to people, and that's been a real focus for LADWP. We've really been focusing on what we call a workplace charging. So if you work in downtown L.A. and you park in a garage in downtown L.A., that there are electric vehicle chargers there. We've been working, for example, with the L.A. Department of Transportation on some of the parking, their parking structures and their parking lots.
Nancy Sutley is Chief Sustainability Officer for the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power, speaking with us about how LADWP is working to get to 80% renewable energy by 2036. Nancy, thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
All right, now to an interesting political development in the state. A San Francisco man is running for California governor in 2022 to protest Facebook's decision to allow political candidates to run false ads on its platform without any penalty. Capital Public Radio's Chris Nichols spoke with him.
Adriel Hampton describes himself as a political activist, one who's pulled a few stunts before. But after he announced his campaign for governor would intentionally run false ads on Facebook, the social media company said he can't exactly do that.
To be singled out for censorship by Facebook specifically because I'm challenging their broken policies and calling for citizen oversight and democratic oversight and legislative hearings in Sacramento, is just, not only is it ludicrous, it's obscene.
Specifically, Facebook says Hampton's ads will be eligible for third-party fact-checking. That means the ads could eventually include warnings that they've been debunked and Facebook could diminish their visibility. Meanwhile, Hampton says other candidates won't be penalized.
So the logic of that is that if you lie about lying, it's okay to run those lies in Facebook, but if you're truthful about lying, you can't lie. You can't run those ads on Facebook.
Amid the Facebook controversy last week, Twitter announced it will stop accepting all political ads. In Sacramento, I'm Chris Nichols.
Grown up is a little different when both of your parents are immigrants, especially those teenage years, and even more weird when you have a crush on someone whose cultural background is not the same as your own. Awkward. That's a good word for some of those conversations you and your parents would have about stuff like that. Coming up, a new novel gets into all of that from a Korean-American perspective. That's coming up when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. Getting through high school is tough, and spending those formative years in Southern California can lead to unique growing pains. Author and illustrator David Yoon took inspiration from his coming of age in Orange County for his debut novel, Frankly in Love. The story follows Korean-American teen Frank Lee and his misadventures of the heart. Yoon came into our studios to talk love, loss, and how family can get in the middle of it all for better and for worse.
Hi, my name is David Yoon, and I'm the author of Frankly in Love, which is my debut novel. So the main character of the book, Frank, is a senior in high school, and he is kind of caught between worlds where he wants to do what he wants, but he has some pretty traditional parents, and they have ideas about who he can date in particular. So Frank is struggling between the diversity that is Southern California and his parents' expectations, which are pretty narrow. So when I was growing up in Southern California, I definitely struggled with similar issues that Frank struggles with, which is, you know, you're Korean-American. And I know a lot of ethnicities, you know, feel the same way. It's ethnicity-American. In my particular case, I never felt Korean enough because I wasn't born there. And I never felt mainstream American enough because that usually defaulted to white. That hyphen is literally a blank space. And when you grow up in that blank space, you want to really desperately belong somewhere, not knowing that the challenge is to create your own sense of belonging. It's really hard. It's a tall order, especially for teenagers. But that's sort of the journey that Frank is faced with. I like to say that Frank is like the version of myself that I wish I could have been. He's a lot wiser than me. He's more woke than I was when I was his age. And I like to joke that Frank gets to learn in a single senior year of high school what took me like 20 years to figure out. So good job, Frank. Good for you. It was important for me to put Frank in an interracial relationship toward the beginning of the book, because when we talk about love, we talk about two people having affection and falling in love and all that great stuff. But around that couple is an entire context of politics and family and friends, and they all have different opinions about what that love means for them. And it in turn affects that love to begin with. When Frank begins to date this white girl, she realizes how little she knows about all these people around her. And he realizes how different their sense of privilege and assumed culture is in the world. And it becomes a point of discussion. But that interface of cultures is what I find fascinating. I really think the book had to take place in Southern California. On the surface, Southern California can look like a very kind of homogenous, especially in the suburbs. But when you look just a little bit deeper, you see all kinds of kids mingling and becoming friends and hanging out. And it actually is one of the most diverse places on the planet. When I was growing up there, we hung out with anyone and everybody. And we just completely took it for granted that half my friends were bilingual and half of them were, you know, had lived in other countries or had parents who were immigrants. And it just felt super normal. We never talked about it. It was just in the air around us. So I felt like that was the perfect place for Frank to have his crazy adventures. Oh, man. So one of the main inspirations for writing Frankly was definitely having my daughter. I mean, she's seven now, but I don't know about you, but when I had her, you know, both me and Nikki could not help but review our own childhoods, because you see the world through a child's eyes again. And I started thinking a lot about middle school and high school and how, you know, my own parents were pretty traditional in terms of who I could date, basically only Korean girls. And I found myself in high school hiding my entire love life from my parents. And looking back, that's a very strange thing to do, to hide something so important from people who are so important in your life. But this time around, the fake dating trope becomes this kind of bomb that explodes the family and exposes all of the, you know, political and racial tensions within immigrant generations, first generation versus second generation, and how to navigate all that. Something that I learned when I was writing this book was that Frank's journey was not only a journey of like romantic love, but his journey was also of his relationship with his parents. And it would have been easy to write a teenager who just kind of hates his parents and is like, screw you guys and I don't need you. But the fact is, Frank, he loves his parents. He can't help but love his parents. And the question becomes, what do you do when you love people who drive you totally insane? You can't just walk away from them, and you still want to be a part of their lives. And so then Frank's journey becomes one of acceptance. And acceptance historically has been one of the hardest things for humans to do, to accept people for who they are without wishing they were someone different. And the next level, sort of the boss level battle after that, is how do you love people again without wishing they're someone different, without judging them? And that is the challenge of our time and kind of every time. And that's what Frank eventually discovers. But no spoilers.
That's author David Yoon talking about his new coming-of-age novel, Frankly in Love, set in the Korean-American community in Southern California. Tomorrow on Take Two, we're going to look back at the 25th anniversary of Proposition 187 and how it changed California. Prop 187 tried to bar immigrants without legal status from state services like public schools and public health care, and it moved many to activism. People like muralist Votan Enriquez, whose art has been influenced by that tumultuous time.
Seeing how a proposition like Prop 187 had an effect on migrant communities and kind of forced Latino people to vote, there's a constant huge wave of consciousness, whether it comes through a negative force that helps people evolve and pushes people out of their comfort zone to become more involved in various ways.
More on that tomorrow on Take Two, starting at 2 o'clock. And that's going to do it for the show today. In case you missed any part of Take Two, we're on at 2 o'clock every single day. But in case you missed it, just go wherever you get your podcast. Look for Take Two, and there we will be waiting to be heard by you. You can also find us all over social media. We're on Twitter, at Take Two. That's at Take Two. And I'm also there as well at A Martinez LA. That's at A Martinez LA. That's good for Twitter and Instagram for your social media convenience. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take Two. We'll be back tomorrow at 2. Talk to you then.